couple days ago, we saw the importance of nutrition during pregnancy and lactation. We said breast is best. We saw the very great benefits of breastfeeding. We saw that the World Health Organization recommends exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months. And there are many good reasons for that, among them the lesser risk of obesity. And as we will see, obesity is a problem that is increasing rapidly in the developing world. Now, following on in the continuum of feeding, we come to weaning. Anything that is added to the breast milk is considered weaning, whether it's by a cup or by a spoon. Weaning is best if not before 6 months, as we've just said, and that's whether it's another tea, a water, a juice, a cereal, or any other food. Breastfed babies generally do not need any additional water besides the breast milk until weaning. And in some conditions where it may be appropriate for the infant to have food somewhat earlier than 6 months, but in a developing world setting, it's particularly important that exclusive breastfeeding continue for 6 months, and that's the clear recommendation. Well, weaning food is also called complementary food, and ideally it will complement the breast milk that will continue to be given, ideally again, up to 12 to 24 months of age. And we would note 4 points from the World Health Organization about complementary feeding, which is another term for weaning. It should be timely. And all infants should be given complementary feeding from 6 months on, because by that time, a baby will need more nutrients than the breast milk provides by itself. And by that time, the gastrointestinal tract of the infant will be mature enough to handle the other foods. And in addition, the baby will be able to sit without support, and before very long, they will have manual skills to feed themselves. The period from 6 months to 24 months, 18 to 24 months, is a very critical period in the growth of children. It's a time when they are extremely vulnerable. Malnutrition starts in very many infants during this time because they don't have the right kind of food. Complementary food also needs to be adequate. The nutritional value should be at least as good as that from breast milk. But the question in much of the world is, where can a mother like this one find enough nutritious food for her children? Particular nutrients that need attention in complementary foods are protein, iron, zinc, and vitamin A. And iron is particularly important in the development of the brain, not only in the last couple of months of pregnancy, but in the first 2 years in the life of the infant. And a deficit can lead to permanent deficits. Complementary food should also be safe. And care must be taken in the preparation of complementary food to minimize the risk of contamination, whether it's from unsanitary water supplies that too often come from open wells or a ditch across a field or other unsanitary conditions, all of which are part of the realities of the developing world and which pose considerable challenges. But safety of the food that we give to our little ones in the more developed world must also be considered. And fourth, complementary food should be appropriate in texture and quantity, and we must keep in mind that they are not just miniature adults. They need food that is prepared to meet their needs and developmental readiness, and this is true wherever they live. The food may be different in different places, but it should be easily digestible, and it should be smooth and nutrient and energy dense to complement the breast milk. The variety and textures should be increased gradually, and the amount should be enough to support the growth of the infant. Now, this may be more difficult to achieve in developing countries where far too often young children do not have enough food of the appropriate kind. But there are reports of infants in the industrialized world also failing to thrive because they are fed weaning foods that were bulky, with high fiber content, and low energy density. So this point of applicability and appropriateness of the infant's food is true regardless of the setting. Now, these boys are both healthy. Little ones need that extra adipose. I don't know in your different countries if what it's called, but I know it has been called baby fat. in America at times. Little ones need that extra adipose tissue to meet their needs, especially for the developing brain and nervous system during this period of rapid growth. And as they grow and develop, their body proportions and composition will change. We need to remember this statement from Dr. Jennifer Hsu, a physician pediatrician at the Children's Medical Group of Atlanta. She said, "You don't want to restrict fats under age 2 because a healthy amount of fat is important for babies' brain and nerve development." Now, when we talked about pregnancy, we noted the extremely interesting studies that are investigating the outcomes of babies who were born too small, not because they were premature, but because they didn't have adequate nutritional support in utero. One of the outcomes of these studies is that the babies born too small are more likely as adults to be obese and to experience a variety of risk factors for coronary heart disease. And both birth weight and weight at 1 year were inversely related to the risk of coronary heart disease. So these studies show the importance of good nutritional support during pregnancy, but during also that first year of life. But then we might ask, what about the second year? And the studies from Helsinki, if we look carefully at this on the bottom is the birth weight, and it is divided into thirds. And the bars, the different colored bars, represent the BMI at 2 years of age. Now, I might mention that this study was conducted with over 4,600 men and 4,100 women who were born in the Helsinki University Hospital and who attended child welfare clinics in the city. And the children, or the infants and children, were weighed and measured monthly from birth to 2 years and annually thereafter. So what this shows is that the hazard ratios for coronary heart disease by birth weight and BMI. So the lighter blue is the BMI in the lowest third of BMI at 2 years, and then the middle third and the upper third by 2 years, and this is the birth weight. So what you see is that the, and the point for comparison is here at the highest birth weight and the highest body weight at BMI at 2 years of age. So what they show is that those babies who were in the lowest two-thirds of birth weight, and when they were even at the lowest two-thirds of BMI at 2 years of age, had the greatest risk for coronary heart disease as adults. And then we would look at those here who were at the highest third of the birth weight, but if they were now in the lower third of BMI at 2 years, their risk was increased. So what this says is that it's very important to have good nutritional intake during those first 2 years of life, particularly in the little ones who were born at a less than optimal weight. And yet, this is a time when we have seen that the little ones are at greatest risk for malnutrition. And now we see an additional potential consequence for chronic disease as an adult. There are far too many children around the world who do not have as much food as they need. And this is illustrated in this map of stunting in children less than 5. And the darkest red areas represent those areas where more than, and you see some here in Haiti and in parts of Central America, these are countries where more than 40% of the children under 5 are stunted. And we must remember that stunting is the result of a chronic state of too little food. We're talking about food. And there are some 178 million children under the age of 5 years who are stunted. And it often starts in that critical period that we just noted from 6 to 18 to 24 months of age when the complementary food is given, but it's not adequate. Someone just shared with me an experience they had this last week when a baby was brought into the hospital with kwashiorkor, a protein energy malnutrition. There was an older child and a younger child. But this middle child was very, very ill. The younger one was fine. The older one was fine. But this middle one actually died within a couple of days. He was so ill. And it's probable that the oldest child, who was about 8 years old at that time, had had adequate nutrition. The second one maybe had it for a time, but then when the mother became pregnant, and I think this child was 18 months of age, just at that critical period, when the mother became pregnant, had the third baby, then this baby no longer had adequate nutrition. He became sick. But with kwashiorkor, the babies get a lot of edema. They don't look thin. And sometimes the parents don't realize how very, very sick they are. Well, stunting, it isn't just the size that we're concerned about. There was a large study in the Philippines that followed over 2,000 children from birth to adolescence, and they found that stunted children start school later, they miss more school, they repeat more grades, and they drop out more often. So overall, they have fewer days in school. And the results of the poor nutritional status and compromised education are seen because the growth-restricted children had significantly lower scores on cognitive tests compared to the non-growth-restricted children. And they also had more behavior problems. So stunting affects not only just the educational experience, more illnesses, more behavior problems, but then we look to adult productivity. And studies in Guatemala showed that nutrition intervention in pregnancy and early childhood led to increased body size and improved work capacity. And also in Guatemala, they found that improved nutrition before but not after 3 years of age was associated with higher hourly wages in men. That's about a 46% increase in wages, and that's a pretty good increase. In China, exposure to famine in early life was associated with shorter stature and lower income. So the problem of undernutrition the problems of undernutrition in more developed countries may not be as great in sheer numbers of children or severity as was seen on the map of stunting. However, there are children in those countries who experience undernutrition and hunger. And it is quite clear, and the research provides compelling evidence, that undernutrition at any period of childhood can have detrimental effects on the cognitive development of children and their later productivity as adults. And undernutrition harms children silently, even before it is severe, and its results are readily detectable. Inadequate food intake limits the ability of children to learn about the world about them. And here we're not talking about the severely malnourished and stunted child, but about children who are undernourished and even those who are hungry. The National Education Association in the United States reports studies that show hunger disrupts the learning process, and one developmental step is lost and it's difficult to move on to the next one. And that learning process may be in the classroom, it may be on the playground. Teachers can tell which child is hungry. Hunger also leads to nervousness and to disinterest in the learning situation and an inability to concentrate. The mother in this picture is busy with her sewing while the little girl is fully engaged in looking at her book. This is not something she would be doing with much interest if she were hungry. The hungry child is passive and apathetic and timid and demands little from his or her environment. This was from reports from the National Education Association in the United States. We see something in the faces of these boys, something that tells us they're undernourished and hungry. The boy on the left was severely stunted as well as vitamin A deficient. Perhaps they represent an extreme in a sense, but certainly they're not as extreme as others. But the statements we've just read about hunger have come from studies in the United States. And certainly the effects of hunger don't change. The World Health Organization speaks of a hidden hunger because of the lack of essential vitamins and minerals in the diet. Now, in these, we're not talking about a stunted child generally, although I'm sure that they're hungry too, but we're talking about a hungry child, a child who goes to school without an adequate breakfast. Before I go on to the next, I just say when I was in Haiti some years ago, and they told where I took these pictures, and they talked about the mothers who would take their little ones out to the field with them when they had to go to work, and they'd set the children beside the field while they worked, and the children would just stay there. As we noted, they're apathetic, and they demand little from their environment. But then they started a feeding program, and they began to feed these little children, and they began to be interested in what was around them, and they didn't want to sit beside the field anymore where their mothers worked. And it's kind of a sad commentary that it actually, feeding these children made it more difficult for these hardworking mothers when the children had food rather than when they were hungry. Well, there have been many studies of the effects of breakfast, and the outcomes aren't always consistent because the study designs are different and the settings are different in many ways. But there have been some reviews, and this report is the result of 47 different studies. And they found that children who reported eating breakfast consistently tended to have superior nutritional profiles. They were less likely to be overweight. And the students, even though they consumed more calories, we would note that. And the students who eat breakfast may have better academic performance and test scores, and they also have better school attendance. So better breakfast is important. Just in the last year, there have been many papers from countries around the world looking at the benefits of breakfast. And here's summaries from a few. A study in India found that breakfast was beneficial to school achievement. A study in Canada found that eating breakfast was associated with a healthy body weight. And another from Greece found that eating breakfast was inversely associated with overweight and obesity in 10 to 12-year-old children. In the U.S., a study of African-American children found breakfast consumption was associated with improved weight and nutrient adequacy. So there's a good deal of interest in documenting the benefits of eating breakfast in many different countries. You notice that several of these studies, as well as others we haven't noted, have found that children and adults who eat breakfast have a better weight status. And this brings us to an immense and growing problem all around the world, obesity. And this is not, as we might think, just a problem of industrialized societies. Perhaps you've heard the new term, globesity. The statistics are quite staggering. In 2005, there were 1.7 billion overweight adults. Now, what we are particularly interested in is the 155 million children worldwide who are obese or overweight. And in some developing countries, up to 25% of the children are overweight. So it's paradoxical that globesity coexists with undernutrition, and both coexist with poverty. If you live in one of the poorest countries in the world, you will likely be underweight and malnourished. If you are poor in one of the so-called middle-income countries, where the per capita gross national product is about $3,000 a year, you are at increased risk of obesity. We would do well to take note of a recent statement from the journal Pediatrics. Excessive calorie intake does not imply adequate nutrition. Sometimes the term overnutrition is used in talking about overweight or obesity, and I rather object to that because over something, it sounds like it's a lot of good stuff, and it really isn't a lot of good stuff. And in fact, there are many studies, many, many studies that show that the obese individuals, overweight individuals, have poor nutritional intake. Well, we might want to know what can be done to slow this obesity trend. One of the first things is to make sure that the moms have good nutrition during pregnancy so their babies will be able to be born at appropriate weight. And the second is to encourage that exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months, because babies who are breastfed are less likely to be obese as adults. And third, we've just noted the appropriate use of complementary food. And fourth is to make sure that little ones from birth to 2 years of age have nutritious food. And fifth, as we've just seen, make sure the children have a good breakfast. And we, in the next presentation, we'll talk about a couple other things. Investigators are now looking at the rate of growth, that is, how fast a child grows after 2 years of age and its relationship to adult outcomes. And the researchers in the Helsinki study compared the BMI at 2 and the BMI at 11 and the risk of coronary heart disease. And this is what they found. Now we have the BMI at 2 years of age divided into equal thirds on the bottom, and the different colored bars represent the BMI at 2 years of age. And now our point of reference is the highest BMI at 2 and the lowest BMI at 11. And what you see here is that the ones who were had the lowest BMI at 2 years of age, when they had the highest BMI at 11, were at the highest risk. And you see a graded increase and somewhat of an increase in the middle group as well. Whereas in those who had the highest BMI at 2 years of age and still were at the highest BMI at 11, did not have a greatly increased risk. Well, so one of the things that this is saying, and that investigators are looking at, is trajectory of growth, and that is how fast the child is growing, and particularly after 2 or 3 years of age, and especially in children who are born small. Now, and we'll see some other issues in the next session. We don't want to imply that heart disease and its associated risk factors are all controlled by birth weight and the BMI at 2 or 11 years of age. But we certainly understand that adult lifestyle plays a significant role, but what is becoming more and more clear is that there are very early influences, even before a baby is born and during the early years, that can affect health in later years. So we have a challenge. It's a great challenge. It's a global challenge. On the one hand, we have undernutrition, and on the other hand, we have obesity. Currently, it is recognized that there are relationships between an infant's size at birth and at 1 and 2 years of age and adult health, and also between how fast a child grows from age 2 and adult health. So, food is indeed the foundation for our children's future. There's a couple of statements that I would call your attention to. They were made quite a few years ago. The first one in 1899. It says, children and youth should not be underfed in the least degree. They should have an abundance of healthful food. And the second one was from 1903, and it was a report to the Royal Commission on Physical Training to the British House of Commons. And it said, unless children receive proper nourishment, they cannot be expected to profit by the mental and physical training provided to them. Now, back at those years, they may not have understood all of the mechanisms nearly so well as is understood today, although I'm sure there's much more to learn. But they did understand the relationship between nourishing food and children's development. And finally, someone said, if we care about our children and if we care about their education, we should care about their nutrition. And now I will switch to another program here, and we will continue our discussion with a talk about adolescence.